Same a blessing, we'll get going. Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam. Asha kiddushanu baruch acha v'tzivanu lasok b'dovrecha. Amen. And yes, the book of Revelation, this, would you believe, is part 47. And we'll do a huge chunk of chapter 17. Well, actually the first two verses. And the reason is, actually, these two verses are very relevant for current affairs right now. So I want to spend a bit of time to tease that out. If you weren't here last Sunday, we took another vote. About a year ago, we voted to do Revelation every Sunday, right? Because it's going to take a long time. But we're about 75% of the way through now. So we took another vote last Sunday to see if people wanted it broken up a little. And the vote was, by a narrow margin, to do a topical teaching every other Sunday just to relieve the broken showers for a bit, you know. And what we did last Sunday was a bit of a half and half, and that was one of the options as well. And so in the other half last Sunday, we introduced a topical series with a short teaching called Thoughts on Evangelism, and that was part one, public gospel proclamation in the book of Acts. And of course, the other portion was Revelation 46, chapter 16, verses 17 to 21. Now, if you've only just joined us, just a reminder that the book of Revelation is a genre of literature called Jewish apocalyptic. And so it was a common way of writing back in the day, and it contains a lot of symbols. And the trick is trying to discover what the symbols are. The Old Testament teaches us a lot. Other non-scriptural apocalyptic writings teach us a lot. And some of it comes down to sanctified guesswork. So we do our best. But last Sunday, we saw the seventh and final bowl judgment. And I stand by my claim that there's enough overlap between the seal judgments, the trumpet judgments, and the bowl judgments to not see them as sequential, but rather as a general description of the events that will transpire leading to the return of Messiah. Now, at the end of each of these three series of judgments, there was a statement along the lines of, it's all over, Red Rover. There were signs of judgment, pretty much identical signs each time. On two out of three occasions, there was hail. And on the other three occasions, there was sounds, thunders, lightnings, and a great big earthquake. In the seventh trumpet judgment last Sunday, we saw that the earthquake divided the great city into three parts. And we said, okay, what city is that? And it could figuratively be speaking of Babylon, which in itself is a figure, a symbol. But then we looked at a text in the book of Zechariah, which is also apocalyptic, by the way, and it may not be literal. But it seemed to suggest that when the Lord returns to the Mount of Olives, it'll split in two, along an east-west fault line, which would indeed divide Jerusalem, the other great city, into three parts. So who knows, maybe it's literal. We concluded last Sunday with two statements. One of them is God's judgments increase in severity. Why? As an act of mercy to the undecided. Nobody will be able to say when the Lord returns, well, I didn't know he was cross. Things will get worse and worse and worse. Be that as it may, the wicked will not repent, and this is not thus saith the Lord, just conjecture, but watch them blame it on climate change. You see, Greta was right. That's why we're having, you know, pestilence and plague and all these things. And the third thing we concluded with was a question. What do we need another six chapters of Revelation for if we've seen it end three times? Well, let's move on and see what we can find. And to set the scene this morning, I want to go back to the fall, all the way back to Genesis 3, and ask the question, why did it happen? Genesis 3, verses 4 and 5. Then the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God. There it is. That's the inherent weakness of mankind. We have this desire, like little children, to demonstrate that we're all grown up and we don't need God telling us what to do, like a toddler. Me do it myself. You ever wonder why toddlers are like that? That's God's way of showing us what we're like. Good news is, of course, that God's always had a plan of redemption for mankind. Who do you suppose would be the beneficiaries of this free gift of salvation? Would it be the arrogant who want to live without God? Well, yeah, I was one of them until God brought me to my knees. But it's those of us who are in this room and other places like this morning are those who have humbled themselves in repentance and faith. And that's a minority of people, isn't it? Everyone else has all grown up. We've seen that the Bible shows two lines of people. Cain killed Abel, so it was the third son of Adam and Eve, Seth. There was a godly line from Seth, but not from Cain. Isaac was the godly line, not Ishmael. Esau, not Jacob, not Esau. Sorry, Lord. Jacob, not Esau. Or you could say that it's the tale of two people, the population figuratively of Jerusalem and the people of Babylon. And let's just remind ourselves of how Babylon got going in Genesis 11, verses 3 and 4. Then the people said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They had brick for stone and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens." What do they want to do that for? "Let us make a name for ourselves." There it is again. I don't need God. Let me show you what I can do. Oh, I might worship a few false gods because I can manipulate them to get what I want. But I don't want anything to do with the one true God. Did they achieve their aim? Verse 8. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. So the short answer is no. The long answer is no. But they did make a name for themselves. Look at this. Verse 9, therefore its name is called Babel. Babel roughly translates to confusion, but the Hebrew word Babel is translated Babylon in our English Bibles elsewhere in the scriptures, because that just comes from the Greek. But Babel, 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 Babylon, same place. Now that we know what it represents and how it got started, what can we learn about it in the last days? And I think we're living in them. Chapter 17, verse 1. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters." Now, there are symbols here, of course, but we don't have to struggle to figure out some of them. Many waters, for example, is explained to us in verse 15, which we won't get to this morning. He said to me, "The waters which you saw, where the prostitute sits, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages." Quite clearly, this is not a literal prostitute. So, that being the case, what does she represent? Well, that's explained in verse 18. "The woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth." And the context of chapter 17 suggests that this is the city of Babylon, which in itself is a figure, right? Why is she called a great prostitute? Well, it's clearly not a term of endearment, right? It's consistent with her wicked status. And in the Old Testament, there are a couple of pagan cities accused of being harlots. Isaiah refers to the ancient city of Tyre, which is in modern-day Lebanon. Isaiah 23, verse 16. "Take a harp, go about the city, you forgotten harlot. Make sweet melody, sing many songs that you may be remembered." Now, I'm guessing a forgotten harlot is like a working girl who's way past her prime and isn't making a lot of money, you know, not doing too well. There's a similar text in the book of Nahum, chapter 3, verse 4, referring to the capital of ancient Assyria, which was Nineveh. And these are insults, okay? These are just, this is God's, "What I think of you, you pathetic lot." But usually, harlots refer, or harlotry is an accusation against Israel and Judah in the Old Testament. Hosea 9:1, for example. Do not rejoice, O Israel, with joy like the other peoples, for you have played the harlot against your God. Well, what does that mean? Well, in ancient times, a betrothal was binding, and you had to get a divorce to break off an engagement. And usually that was only happened in cases of infidelity, which is why when Joseph found out Mary was pregnant, it said he had in mind to divorce her quietly. In the Old Testament, the prophetic or the symbolism is that the people of Israel are betrothed to God. It's binding. The wedding hasn't happened yet, but it's binding. And in that time, they played the harlot by worshipping other gods. They prostituted themselves. And to illustrate God's grief at this, poor old Hosea the prophet had to marry a harlot, you know, so that at least he knew God's heart. The harlot later in this chapter is seen riding on the beast, and she has gotten rich by worshipping the false god of the beast empire. Now, we've already looked at this throughout Revelation so far, but the beast empire has two components. There's the multi-headed sea beast. This one's only got one, but I like the picture. The multi-headed sea beast is the geopolitical empire, the wicked empire of the last days. The beast from the earth, or the earth beast, is the religious aspect of that empire. It is a religio-geopolitical empire, and it's based on the teachings of the false prophet. And that's why, for many, many years now, I've been saying, if Messiah returns in our lifetime, I am convinced the evil beast empire will be some kind of Islamic caliphate. Gaza is the focus point at the moment for most of the world. But our African brothers and sisters have been putting up with the beast for decades. Have you ever heard of ISMP? I hadn't heard about it till during the week. It stands for the Islamic State of Mozambique Province. Here's one of their propaganda pictures of them with their flag. Last month they burnt down 23 churches. All right, they can be rebuilt. But they also beheaded 30 Christians. Where's the protest flotilla? Right? Where's the social action? Who cares? That's Africa. We don't care about them, do we? And just by the way, try and tell these people you don't need to worry because Jesus is going to rapture all the Christians to heaven before it gets tough. Yeah, right. But Houston, we have a problem. And that is that Revelation chapter 18, which we certainly won't get to today, probably not till after Christmas, the way I'm going. But we see the judgment upon Babylon. Here we go. Revelation 18, verse 4, I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you have no participation in her sins and that you don't receive of her plagues. My people? It seems that in the last days, some of God's people will be part of Babylon. And Babylon is a harlot that worships the false god. How can that be? Well, I think there are two possibilities. The first is professing Christians. Now, professing Christians, I'm talking about them who support Islam or ignore what Islam is doing, either because they believe the victim narrative that's been forced down our throats for so long, or it's out of convenience, or they say, all religions lead to God. Let's all sing Kumbaya together. In our parallel series last Sunday, if you weren't here, we looked at the four major groups of Christianity. There's the Catholics, the Evangelical Protestants, the Liberal Protestants, and the Orthodox. Could any of these groups, do you think, play the harlot and stand in favour of the beast and his false empire, whether by conviction or convenience? Yes. Somebody said yes. How about these guys, Liberal Protestants? Well, too late, they already do. Now, hear me, folks. I'm not talking about every Christian who attends a liberal church, you know. I know some very godly folks who hang in there by their fingernails in the Uniting Church to be salt and light when all their brothers and sisters said, I've had this, I'm out of here. But yes, they could, couldn't they? What about the Orthodox churches? Coptic, Greek, Russian. Yep, too late again. Here's an archbishop or whatever he is marching for Palestine. Catholics? That's a tricky one, you know, because as Protestants, we tend to think of the Roman Catholic Church as this great sprawling homogenous mass, but it actually isn't. There's a lot of difference between not just parishes, but dioceses and even nations. And there's a lot of different opinions amongst Roman Catholics, irrespective of what we might think as Protestants. I don't wish to be unkind, but in Latin American countries, Catholicism is like a syncretist folk religion. It's almost, well, it is pagan, you know. And I've joked in the past about my private audience with John Paul II, where I got a ticket for it, and there were 7,000 of us in an auditorium in Rome, in the Vatican, and the Pope came in. But there was a lot of folks from Latin America, I assume, and they had icons and paintings, and they wanted them to get spiritual power from the presence of the Holy Father. You know, it was so sad. You know, shoes of the fishermen, all that. Peter said, don't do that. Get on your feet. I'm just a man. Even as I'm sure most popes would say. But to these people, and so my point in saying that is that I think there are Catholics who would be swayed by the opinion of the incumbent pope. Now we have We have a new pope, and according to the recent edition of Vatican News, he was interviewed about the two-state solution. And he said, the Holy See recognised the two-state solution some time ago. That is clear. We must seek a path that respects all peoples. Well, I would say, yeah, except Israel. You're not respecting them. But while I disagree with that, that's kind of just political speak, isn't it? That's the sort of thing you'd expect a politician to say. But then he was asked, what about all the nations who recently recognised Palestine at the UN? Do you think that'll help? And he said, and I'm quoting, it could help, but right now there is no willingness to listen on the part of the other side. Dialogue is broken. The pontiff is laying the blame squarely upon Israel and those who would support Israel. And that disturbs me. So, maybe some Catholics. And that just leaves lucky last, doesn't it? Is it possible for evangelical Protestants to support the beast, do you think? Well, these two organisations claim to be comprised of evangelical Christians. Christ at the Checkpoint in the UK. They're active in the boycott, divest, sanction Israel, doing anything they can to promote the Palestinian cause. They claim to be evangelical believers. In the US, Christians for a Free Palestine. Same deal, claim to be evangelicals. Now, in fairness, most of these in the US branch are kids, 18 and 20s, you know. And I know at that age I knew everything too. I'm cleverer than them. I knew everything without social media telling me what I had to know. So, you know, maybe some of these kids will grow up, who knows. But is it Britain who just lowered the voting age to 16? Yeah. Now, as the next election comes round in Oz, if it's not a shoe-in for the government, watch them do the same. So, there are 2.5 billion professing Christians in the world today. Let's be generous. Let's say 40%, either through conviction or convenience, support the beast. That's a billion people. That's more than Tasmania. It's a lot of folks, you know. It's even more than the mainland, I think. Although when I go to Sydney and Melbourne, I'm not sure. Seems like there's about a billion of them. The second possibility is a Judeo-Christian heritage. Now, this map, the purple countries are predominantly Christian. They don't always have the biggest populations, but they're predominantly Christian. And that's because Christian missionaries went all around the world and they got to the purple places mostly, and those countries were founded on that base. Now, this green bit here was also purple once, but it's been conquered by Islam. Could any of those purple places betray their heritage and side with Babylon and the beast? Well, here's another map for you. These are the countries in dark green around the world that have recognised the state of Palestine, non-existent state of Palestine. Don't worry about the mid-shade green. That's they've got diplomatic status or something. But the dark green recognises the state of Palestine. The only ones who don't are the grey ones. The only major player in the world which did not go along with them is New Zealand. No, wait, not New Zealand. Though, bless them, they didn't. It was America. It was the other great power in the world, right? USA, New Zealand, and a couple of odds and ends did not go along with the flow. Believe it or not, this is a page from a Bible, a medieval Latin Bible, on our passage this morning. Can you believe it? And it shows the Apostle John and the angel and the harlot sitting on the waters. How'd you like that? Wouldn't you like to have something like that just as a treasure, you know? Anyway, what motivates a prostitute? Career? Probably not. Ka-ching! It's usually money, isn't it? You wouldn't do any other reason. Yeshua said, Matthew 6:24, no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Mammon is an Aramaic word, but here it's from the Greek. Mammonas just means worldly riches. Here's the thing. What worldly riches do politicians crave? Is their main pursuit money? No, that's probably their second main pursuit. I mean, within 10 minutes of getting into office, they changed the rules so that if you've been a politician for 10 minutes, you get a lifetime pension of $80 billion or something. But somebody said it. Power, did someone say? Yeah. What they really crave is power, your votes. They'll do almost anything for power. And that's precisely what the leaders of the Green Nations have done in the last couple of weeks. Nations like Britain, France, Canada, and Australia have sold their souls to terrorists in exchange for votes. Here's our illustrious leader who refused to visit Israel. Here he is just in the last week or two in a big mosque in the Emirates. And, you know, that's bad enough. But you know what he said when he was there? This is a quote. He said, you get the feeling when you are here about the human experience and how humble we are before the glory of God. Does he honestly think the glory of the one true God, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Israel, dwells in a mosque? What planet is this man on? Let's ask the one true God what he says. Isaiah 43:8, I am the Lord, that is my name. Well, that's not his name, is it? That's what we write in English. His name is YHVH. We don't know how to pronounce it. We don't say it. He is Hashem, he is Adonai. That's his name. That is his covenant name with his people. And he says, my glory I will not give to another. God's glory does not reside in the temples of Satan. Still, the next verse in our passage this morning predicts this kind of appalling behaviour. Revelation 17:2, with whom the kings of the earth, he's one of them, committed sexual immorality, figuratively speaking, of course. What does it lead to? Those who dwell in the earth were made drunken with the wine of her sexual immorality. What's drunkenness? What's it like to be drunk? I don't know. Well, that's... Maybe once upon a time I could have told you, but, you know, it's to be confused, isn't it? To do stupid things. You don't know what you're doing. To be irresponsible and confused. Now, wait a minute, confusion, that's Babylon, isn't it? Oh, yes. What a coincidence. You say, Michael, you're making a mountain out of a molehill? Well, maybe. But we saw a couple of weeks ago that the Bible predicts the final showdown between civilization and barbarism will take place right here in the valley of Jezreel near Tel Megiddo. Joel 3:2, I will also gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. It's the valley of Jezreel. Jehoshaphat means the Lord judges. And I will enter into judgment with them there. Why? On account of my people, my heritage, Israel. Whom they have scattered among the nations. Who did that? When did Israel get scattered? Well, the Assyrians conquered them in the 8th century, didn't they, BCE, and the Babylonians in the 6th and everything. And then every other man and his dog has conquered them at some stage. But they weren't scattered until the 2nd century under the Emperor Hadrian. At the end of the Bar Kokhba revolt, he said, I've had enough of you guys, out. Every single one of you last Jews, get out of Judea. Kick them all out to the four corners of the earth, among the nations, as the text says, that was written hundreds and hundreds of years before. And he renamed Judea Philistina, after the Philistines. That's why it's called Palestine. But there's another thing. They have also divided up my land. Whose land is it? Is it Arab land? Is it Jewish land? No, it is God's land. And they have divided it. Now, like I said, people have ruled over the place, come and gone. But who's actually divided it into chunks? That didn't happen in the 2nd century. This is probably the approximate dimensions of the promised land from the Nile to the Euphrates. It's a guess because the southern border there is, we don't really know where the southern border is. That's an artist's impression. In 1917, this part of the promised land was under British control. Let's make it a bit bigger. The light and darker blue bits were the British mandate. The pink bits, Syria there, given to the French. Arabs got the southern bit, which is in Arabia, now Saudi Arabia. And what the Brits, lovely folks that they were, they said, the dark blue bit, which looks like an axe, we're going to create a Jewish homeland for that. That is the mandate for a Jewish national home, and we'll call it Palestine. 120,000 square kilometres. Problem was the discovery of Arab oil. And in 1922, the Brits had another think about it. And they said, tell you what, we might divide the state of Palestine into two halves. We'll have Arab Palestine or Transjordan to the east of the Jordan River, and the Jews can have the other bit. We haven't found any oil there. That can be Jewish Palestine. 92,000 square kilometres for the Arabs, 28,000 square kilometres for the Jews. Just a little bit bigger than the biggest cattle station in Australia. Now, is it St. Anna's in South Australia? It's 24,000 square kilometres. But anyway, this was the first offer of a two-state solution, and the Arabs rejected it. Fast forward to the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, and this bit was now shrunk to the green bits. So, 14,900 square kilometres, a little over half a cattle station. Again, second offer of a Palestinian state. They rejected it again and went to war. But I would call that dividing God's land, wouldn't you? Does God care about what happened in the 20th century with stuff like that? Well, here's a question for you. Where is the British Empire today? I think God cares about that stuff. The Gaza Strip is a tiny piece of real estate in God's land. Oops, I went ahead of myself there. Oh, it's 365 square kilometres. I must have forgot to save it when I put that down. It's tiny, right? But God cares about it. In 1994, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin agreed to the Oslo Accords that were pushed by President Clinton, along with the terrorist Yasser Arafat, for crying out loud. I mean, President Trump's trying to get a Nobel Peace Prize. I wouldn't bother. If they can give one to Arafat, my dog could get one. But anyway, and agreed to what they said is a precursor for the two-state solution, that what we'll do is we'll grant some autonomy to the Palestinian people of Gaza, and they can have some infrastructure and so forth. And the next year he was assassinated. Now, I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying that's a fact. Oh, there we go. 365 square kilometres, one for each day of the year. 2005, Ariel Sharon, then Prime Minister, again ordered all the Jews to leave the Gaza Strip under the influence of George W. Bush to create a little tiny Palestinian state, 365 square kilometres. In January of 2006, they had free and fair democratic elections and voted the terrorist organisation Hamas in to be their representatives. The same month, Prime Minister Sharon had a massive stroke and remained in a vegetative state until his death a number of years later. Does God care about his land being divided, do you think? And by the way, that's why the PA leader, Fatah, you've got Fatah and Hamas, they hate each other, but they both hate Israel even more. He hasn't had any elections since 2005 because he knows that the people will vote for Hamas and he'll lose his job. Now almost the whole world is falling over itself to divide God's land irrevocably. My next slide originally said, will Hamas accept Trump's peace plan? And then I looked at the news yesterday. But my original slide said, at the risk of plagiarising the Apostle Thomas, I doubt it. And then I looked at the news yesterday and it said, Hamas agrees to release the hostages, blah, blah, blah. So what I say to you now is, I still doubt it. I don't believe it. Could be wrong. The devil's in the detail. They've agreed to it and immediately enter negotiation, which is, once again, they'll play for time, they'll whine and complain. They'll whine and complain, and eventually they'll have a hissy fit and say Israel has blocked the peace process again and leave in disgust. Excuse me. Some say Hamas have caved to pressure from other Islamic nations like Egypt, Jordan, Pakistan, UAE, Qatar, Turkey, the Palestinians, of course, Saudi Arabia, and even Indonesia. What if it really happens? What if there really is peace in the Middle East now, after this next few days? Well, in that case, we might have Jeremiah's prophecy. Jeremiah 8:11, for they have healed the hurt of the daughter of my people slightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. The Bible talks about a false peace. The Bible even talks about somebody brokering peace in the Middle East, playing a trump card maybe, and then reneging after 3.5 years. I don't know. But if they do renege again, when they do say no, the Israeli Prime Minister has threatened to reclaim parts of the West Bank. Well, that'll go down well, won't it? And that would effectively put the kibosh on any future two-state solution. Remembering, of course, that in 2000, President Clinton and Ehud Barak offered the Palestinians their own state. They gave them 99% of what they demanded. And yet Arafat left in a hissy fit. No, I don't want that. It wasn't good enough. They don't want a two-state solution. They want a one-state solution with no Israel. Same again in 2008, the number of times they've been offered a state. In my opinion, the Palestinians don't want a state in coexistence from Israel. That's what from the river to the sea means, from the Jordan River and going west across to the Mediterranean Sea. In contrast, the Jews were promised this blue belt, 120,000 square kilometres in 1917. It was reduced to, what did we say it was, 29,000 kilometres or something? In 1922, and then reduced again to 14,900 square kilometres. And they said, we'll take it already. And the Arabs said no and went to war. The 47th president has publicly opposed any move to reclaim the West Bank. He's saying don't do it. But what he says and what he does are sometimes different things. He's perhaps a little unpredictable. But if Netanyahu does go ahead with it and annexes or reclaims some of the West Bank, can you imagine the fuss these folks will make? Either way, It could even go both ways, couldn't it? We could have the false peace and then the, you know, whatever it may be. Oops. But whatever happens in the days ahead, we're living in interesting times. And as the chapter continues, John sees a vision of the harlot riding the beast, as I mentioned before, and we're given some insight as to what will happen to Babylon in perhaps the very near future. Stay tuned. What can we take away? We are living, in my opinion, at a critical moment in history. Things may return to normal, in which case we can cancel the May Day. If not, the Lord is returning very, very soon. Question: what is your focus in life right now? Saving for more in retirement? Career advancement? You know, what is it? Just have a think about it, eh? Next Sunday, topical series, just to something a bit lighter. We'll do Thoughts on Evangelism, Part 2, Personal Witness in the Book of Acts. Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam, asher natan lanu dvarim et Yeshua meshecheinu, v'chayei olam nata betachenu. Baruch ata Adonai, noten dvar. Amen.